you know, to me, leadership is getting people to do what I need them to do or what the company needs them to do because they want to do it. And that sounds contrived, but at the end of the day, what we're trying to do as leaders is motivate people, energize people, get them to rally around a cause, right, that is shared. And that's what's best for the company, but because they want to be part of this thing, right? And that's whether you're leading a sales team, that's whether you're leading a core development team at SAP, and that's whether you're leading an eighth grade baseball team, by the way. I mean, it's all the same. Getting people to do what you need them to do because they want to do it is all about that inner motivation. And and the best leaders understand how different individuals are motivated, right? What gets them energized? Because they're all different.
Welcome to the Follow My Lead podcast, where we transfer stories and best practices of today's leaders to the leaders of tomorrow with your host, John Eads.
Welcome to another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. I'm your host, John Eads. You can find me on social media at John G. Eads. And today we're joined by a real New Yorker. Bob Skay has over 25 years of executive business experience. He's currently the head of the Americas for Dun & Bradstreet, overseeing $1.2 billion in revenue and hundreds of sales and service professionals. I originally met Bob when he was with Interactive Data Corporation, when he was the North American VP of Sales. He just has tremendous experience from very large companies all the way to startup software companies. It was just too much. He has too much knowledge not to dig into and pass on to you. So I was really excited that he agreed to be on the show. We touched on a lot of things, including why having your own leadership style is so important, what his definition of leadership is and where it came from, what people are really motivated by and why each person needs to be motivated by different things. He talked about four ways to stand out as a professional. He went into detail about each one. I thought it was really an insightful point. And so we cover those in great detail. So I think you're going to love the show. He's a really, really exceptional businessman, father, husband. He touched on his family, just a lot of good stuff. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Bob Skay. Just a quick housekeeping item. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft, a professional development company focused on providing education that delivers value for the modern professional. Check out their online leadership programs, blogs, resources, and podcasts at learnloft.com. Their brand new 10-day leadership challenge program is set to be released this week, filled with leadership videos, challenges, and social interactions to help you become a better leader in just 10 days. Well, Bob, thanks for being on the show.
You bet, John. Good to hear from you again.
Well, it's, you know, for people that don't know Bob Skay or anything about Dun & Bradstreet, what is... Just give the audience a little taste of who you are, how old you are, where you live, a little bit of your personal life, just so they get a little flavor of who you are.
Sure. So, you know, from the Northeast originally and the New York area, actually, and Jersey City, in fact, a very, very urban thing. So I consider myself a bit of a New Yorker and grew up in a big family in the city and went to Rutgers University in Newark, jumped over to Manhattan and started working with Chase Manhattan pretty early, and spent 15 or 16 years there, and have jumped around a couple of spots since. But most of my my professional career has been in financial services, data analytics, and technology. 15 years at Chase, and joined a research company called Multex, which was then acquired by Reuters. After Reuters, I ran a small startup, not unlike what you're doing in the wealth management space. It was a true software company called North Star. I spent about 5 years there running the company. Ultimately, we sold that off to SEI and joined Interactive Data back in the financial services information space, and now with Dun & Bradstreet. So, flip some calendars, as you can hear, but kind of a range of experiences on the professional side, from, you know, big chunky bank in Chase, where I spent 15 years and got a lot of my formative fundamental training. We talk more about that, and then jumped around to startups. You know, Multex was a startup. You know, we grew that to $80 million and sold it, and then I went to Reuters, a larger company, then back to a relative, you know, $1 million startup, stayed there for 5 years. So kind of combination big and small, but primarily in financial services. Dun & Bradstreet's really in the, you know, kind of corporate information, commercial information space. On a personal front, I have four kids. I live out in New Jersey, about 15 miles from the office here, married for 25 years to my wife Lori, and two dogs. I have one son just graduated college and moved out to Manhattan already, so got him off the payroll. That's good. Got two in college right now, and a rising senior in high school. So next year, for the second time, I'll have three in college at the same time, which isn't exactly the way you'd want to plan it. But there we go. So,
you've done a lot of great things, both professionally and certainly personally. Four kids, 25-year marriage, two dogs. I mean, you've kind of modeled what many young professionals would love to have. And so, but the very first time I met you, Bob, in person, I was sitting in a classroom getting ready to do some sales training, and you got up in front of 30, 40 people, and you just owned this room like I had never seen. It was just like the people's eyes were just glued to you, ears were open. It was just something. It was one of these memories that I'll never forget. That just the people that were just so interested in what you have to say. Where did that come from, and how could a young professional or any professional maybe learn from some of those things that you do so well in front of a room?
Well, thank you, John. I mean, that's quite a compliment. I didn't realize they were even listening at the time. but thanks. I think it's a matter of, I'm running sales now. I've done some other things. I've run marketing. I actually ran a software company, so I've run development. I've run marketing. I've done some, kind of strategy work as well. But my core is client facing, and I think the key there, is the fact that your audience, at least in that situation, that situation was where your company was going to train my sales leaders. It's a matter of authenticity, I think, and there's so much of that involved in leadership today. It's critical, right? And what do I mean by authenticity? It's that they see you as one of them, that they see you as someone that has their best interests in mind, and also will get in the trenches with you, and that develops a level of trust. And so when you're able to develop that, and you can build that sense of camaraderie, in particular in a client-facing organization, whether it's sales or service or biz dev or pre-sales, post-sales, when you come in with that credibility, authenticity, you build that trust, and that allows for really candid dialogue. And so, I do recall that day. I don't recall them being glued or anything, but I do know that when I feel at my best, I am feeling a connection to my audience that is genuine and authentic, because we share a common thread, or they realize that I've got level of credibility in terms of what I'm speaking about.
Was there someone in your professional journey that taught you that? Did that come from experience? Did it come from reading? Where did you learn that sense of authenticity and how important it was to kind of sit in their chair, in a sense?
Let me say this. I'll answer your question after I say this. When I was a young professional, first of all, I spent 15 years at Chase, as I mentioned. Chase had fantastic training. There used to be a flippant perception on the street that Chase would train the best and keep the rest. But their training was excellent, and I went through a lot of professional development there. The Center for Creative Leadership down in North Carolina, I went to two or three sessions there. Columbia Business School, we did leadership training there in very small settings. Harvard Negotiation Project, a number of different investments in me. At one point I had a personal coach at a very early age, about 30, 31, 32, 33, and I'll tell you, that's invaluable. So there's no substitute for that type of thing. And to this day, I thank what is now JP Morgan Chase for that investment, because most of what I know in terms of my fundamental foundational leadership style is born of a lot of that training and information. But I will say this, that, you know, around that time and before that time, this concept and notion of leadership I found to be very elusive. And I remember sitting down with, and I still have the recording, with like a two-hour session with one of the executive coaches, and I remember talking openly about what is this ethereal concept of leadership, right? Can we nail it down? Can we pin it down? I'm kind of a black and white. My dad was an engineer, and I try to like really look at process and workflow and be able to pinpoint things statistically measured. And it was just always, it always felt outside my grasp. And then over years of working with people and developing, I became comfortable with a leadership style that I feel suits me well and has worked for me. And there are many different leadership styles. But I point that out, John, only to say that early in one's career, to the extent someone's listening in, if you're thinking, geez, what is this thing? I can't grasp it. It's too ethereal for me, too ambiguous and vague. You know what? It kind of comes about, and I think it ultimately comes about by understanding what your true leadership style is, what your inner style is. So That's kind of my preface to all this. You know, the people and folks in my life, there have been many in my professional life that have helped me along the way. There was someone in particular at Chase who is now retired. His name is Bill Gary. He'd blush if he heard me talking about him. But he was the first one to show me that, you know, building trust and being one of us is really important, because I would have run through a wall for that guy, you know.
Right.
And he picked me out and said, you know, you're someone we want to invest in. I remember I was going to, at Chase, there a lot of opportunities, and I was going to move to Singapore at one point, and it didn't work out because Chase and Chemical merged. And then I was going to move to Atlanta, believe it or not, an area you're familiar with, because it had a Southeast territory. And, you know, Bill said to me, and I'll never forget, he said, look, if you want to go down there, I'll support you. I will. But let's make no mistake, it's not a strategic outpost for Chase Manhattan Bank, and I'll probably lose you to Nations Bank. So if you want to do that, go ahead. But, you know, ultimately, you know, we can talk about your career here. And that was the beginning. And that was probably 1994, which makes me older than electricity, of course. but we then had a conversation about my leading the financial services team at Chase, and that was my first managerial job in 1994, 95, and it took off from there. And so I really credit Bill with that first conversation around what do you want to do, you know, I would have loved to have been in Atlanta, but, you know, it's one of those sliding doors types of things where if that door had opened, my career would have been very different. Instead, I stayed in New York and with Chase, and my career took off, and here I am. So
what's the... You just mentioned about 94, 95, you get your first role thanks to a mentor and someone that had, you know, really your best interest in mind. What was the, if there's something that you could think back to that first managerial role, what was the hardest thing about managing people?
Well, you know, I think the hardest thing in that first role is understanding how to stop doing and start coaching. And, you know, we all feel, you know, I was a pretty successful sales rep prior to that. And so the hardest thing for me, to be very candid and very specific, was being in front of a client with my rep or with my team and not taking over that call because I know I can do it better than them. And so allowing people to grow, and understanding that you have to nurture and allow people to grow and coach and give the right types of feedback is the real kind of growth in there, right? Understanding you're no longer a individual contributor and doer. You got to let go of the reins a little bit and, you know, let them scrape their knees once in a while in low risk settings, by the way.
Right.
And then they can develop. I think that was the hardest thing for me initially. Was learning how to throttle back a little bit.
What about now, right? I mean, really experienced, you've managed thousands of people now in your career in different roles, different types of people. Is it any different now, those challenges, than they were at that 94, 95 range when you were, you know, you first put that put people underneath you?
Yeah, it's definitely different. Obviously, you get comfortable with that letting go. One of the biggest challenges now, I have hundreds of folks around the country, in Latin America, and one of the biggest challenges now is making sure that the communication gets through to everyone in the way that I want. It's an issue of scale now, right? And so you mentioned at the beginning of the call where I was in a room of 30 people and I was able to articulate exactly my vision for where we were, where we wanted to go, why we were doing this thing, and I had a level of credibility there. That's harder to do remotely, and I can't reach 800 people eye to eye all the time. And so the hardest thing for me now, actually, as we here at Dun & Bradstreet start to modernize the culture and be forward-leaning and client-facing and all of those things, the hardest thing now is getting that communication out, getting it consistently into the hands of those who are federated, right? They're all over the country. Some of the, you know, 30% of my folks work from home, and making sure that communication happens. So the challenges and the issues are different, of course, versus 94 when I was the first level sales manager in a big business. You know, now there's you have to manage, you know, up as well and across, and there's a lot of perception and, of course, board level information, and the stakes are much, much higher. That's an obvious dimension that changes.
But at its very core, it sounds like some of the modalities are ensuring that that many people that live across the country or the world get that same purpose, mission, vision, all those things that I heard in that room that day. That at its very core, though, it remains the same. Those things are really important, that they understand the vision and know where you're trying to go and buy into it. So it brings different challenges, but at its core, it's still getting people moving in the same direction and inspiring them to take action. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct. I mean, you know, the fundamentals of leadership don't change. The scale and scope and stakes, and frankly, the risk changes.
Right.
But you're right, it's the same. I mean, look, my favorite definition of leadership, and I heard this many years ago, I think it was at the Columbia leadership training. And it sounds a little crude, but if you really break it down, it makes sense. To me, leadership is getting people to do what I need them to do or what the company needs them to do because they want to do it. And that sounds contrived, but at the end of the day, what we're trying to do as leaders is motivate people, energize people, get them to rally around a cause, right, that is shared. And that's what's best for the company, but because they want to be part of this thing, right? And that's whether you're leading a sales team, that's whether you're leading a core development team at SAP, and that's whether you're leading an eighth grade baseball team, by the way. I mean, it's all the same. Getting people to do what you need them to do because they want to do it is all about that inner motivation. And the best leaders understand how different individuals are motivated, right? What gets them energized? Because they're all different. And, you know, I'm fond of saying that, you know, managing at every level, leading at every level is not very different. I'm a basketball guy from coaching a sixth grade basketball team, you know. You know, Jane has different skills than Jill and has different skills from Jimmy and Joey, and they're in a different place. And getting them to contribute to the team and feel part of that is really important. It's really no different in business, although at a different level, getting folks energized, engaged, and motivated. And as leaders, that's what we're charged with doing.
I got to ask you a tough question now. I just have to do it. Is it okay in the professional world that purpose that you're getting people motivated by, is it okay that it's money? Or does it need to be something else?
Well, I think, you know, if you read about it, that's a great question. But if you read about motivation and incentive, ultimately money doesn't work. It's important, it's there, it's jacks are better. People want to be paid a fair wage no matter what, and they want to be rewarded for their contribution, period, full stop. So it's kind of jacks are better. at the end of the day, the differential with people being motivated or not is acknowledgement and learning and training and development. You know, we're taking a group of folks now who I consider to be, for lack of a better term, our high potential, you know, leaders of today, who can take my role potentially down the road when I get hit by, you know, the proverbial bus, or I like to think of it hitting the lottery maybe. But when I check out, and training and developing those people is not about money. What we're giving them is access to certain types of speakers and leadership and training and group settings and different experiences that will allow them to grow in professional ways. And it's not only all business either. It's a personal thing. You know, our CEO here, Bob Carrigan, who's a very progressive digital leader, you know, from the publishing industry initially, has brought in something called the CEO Leadership Experience, which has as much to do with sustainable high performance and bringing our best selves every day as it does understanding our data, right?
Yeah.
And so I think ultimately, good question, but ultimately, you know, money's jacks are better, and your comp plan and incentive programs are critical. They are behavior modification, but they're kind of base and fundamental. I think people get mostly motivated and energized, in my experience, by making sure they understand how they're appreciated, understanding what their role is, what the vision is, clear, open, candid, trusting communication, right? And then when we can invest in them and show that we care about them, you're going to build an environment where people are highly motivated. That's our goal.
Yeah, Bob, how do you get first of all, it's a fantastic, I mean, even the vision of your CEO and investing in people, I mean, it's just, it is really next generation in a way. Now, the question that I've battled or struggled with is, you know, the next quarter is double as more important than the last quarter. And, you know, this year is more important than the last year. How do you as a leader, and, you know, certainly from an executive leadership standpoint, keep your focus on both the short-term results, but have that long-term vision of the development of people? I mean, and how hard is that for you?
Yeah, and that's the right question, absolutely. Because it is, you know, we are a publicly traded company, and, you know, our financial performance is critical. And I have a big percentage, a large percentage of the overall company under my remit. And it's really important. I think, you know, in the selling function in particular, you know, no one will be surprised that performance is really important. I think to a man, to a woman, and then organizationally, you know, we talk about what the stakes are, what the goals are, what we're trying to achieve, all the while we're caring about that person individually, right? And it's kind of, you know, we're here on the during the Olympics, right, in Rio, and you're probably watching, and I'm watching a little bit. I watched last night. It's always amazing to me and somewhat heartbreaking at times when I was watching the uneven bars last night, and this, you know, girl from, I don't know, I think she was from Russia or something, you know, she fell off the bar, and she went back up, and they, you know, the announcers were saying it's very uncommon, very uncharacteristic for her. And then she, you know, she got back up, she finished her, she's obviously tremendously disappointed. She's worked 4 years for that moment, and it all comes to that, and she just slipped. And she came off that stage and walked over, and her coach came up and hugged her, you know. So I don't want to get too schmaltzy here, but I thought in that moment was that the, you know, as long as people are giving you everything they've got, right, as long as they are leaving it all on the field, right, you know, when things don't break their way, you try to think through what we could have done differently, make it a learning moment, make it a coaching moment, and then you move, and then you charge forward, right? And so, you know, results are critically important. There's no question. You know, I often say my job is like coaching the Knicks, right? It doesn't matter if you're going to the Hall of Fame, man. You got to win games, right? So
they're not winning many games right now, though, Bob.
I know, which is why the coach keeps getting fired, by the way.
Now, it's a really brilliant example, right? I mean, these athletes train 4 years for something, and in a moment, it's either glory or pure disappointment. And to see their coach have to hug or lift up or, you know, cry with them, right? I mean, when some of these Americans won, I mean, just pure tears of joy. It's real life, and it happens every day in the professional world. And so it's a really great example. Let's move on to a little bit something. What advice would you give a young professional that has a desire to lead others professionally? What are some of the specific things that you look for, or that you did look for, in this group of what you called high performers?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, there's certain things that I look for when I work with others. One is really just a natural work ethic around what you're trying to get done. So that to me, that comes through first, right? The second one is an ability to connect with others, you know, that emotional quotient. There are plenty of really, really smart people that I've worked with over the years that are just fantastic, you know, business people and even business leaders that may not have the ability to get to a certain level because they don't have the emotional quotient to do that. So I look for that as well. So I look for that work ethic, you got to be smart, and then the emotional quotient of being able to connect with people. After that, it's really about being in the detail, you know, from a leadership perspective. And I learned this from someone some years ago, and that was the feedback I consistently got from various coaches and leaders, is that I needed to be more into the detail, and I learned that the hard way. But it's so important. Truly understand the business, because that gives a level of credibility to those you would lead. Right?
What would be an example of the details? I mean, I have an idea in my mind, but I'm curious, just, you know, something that comes to mind in your world where you didn't worry about the details enough early on, and then you learned to pay attention to them later because you understood how important it was.
Yeah, so, you know, most of this comes from my Chase days, but, you know, early on, I didn't understand certain aspects of how our business worked. You know, certain product lines and or technologies and or how the financial aspect of it worked, right? So when I got into settings, either with people that reported to me or with people that were senior to me, my boss and his boss and her boss, you know, if I didn't have that level of knowledge, I was either exposed meeting with leaders, meeting with executive management above me in a setting where I didn't want to be exposed because I hadn't done my homework well enough. Or, you can recover from that, by the way, or even worse, being with the people that report to me and not truly understanding what they do or what their struggles are or what's challenging to them, or asking them how you can help them. And so coming in at a high level and being a little naive to what's happening on the ground with the people in the field, with the people that report to you, that's harder to recover from, to be honest.
Yeah, I think of a personal story when you just said that. I didn't understand how revenue was recognized. You know, when, just because revenue was booked doesn't mean it can be recognized from a tax perspective till maybe 2, 3, 4 quarters later. And I'll never forget sitting in an executive meeting in my prior company in a board meeting, and I was the only guy in the room that didn't know it, right? And it put me at a significant disadvantage. And so I think that's just a real life example of, you know, how revenue is booked is something in the details that you just have to know when you get up into the upper ranks. And so it sounds like you probably had some similar experiences through your career.
Yeah, no question. And that's one in particular, right? I ran a software company for a while. The various revenue recognition policies in software are different from other businesses I had been in. I wasn't quite aware. And there were a couple of times when I was caught off guard. understanding, you know, the way the products and the way your organization intertwines and who delivers what for whom. So getting into conversations and things that I should know and I didn't know. There was one time where a specific partner was put on the table, and I wasn't aware who that partner was, and I knew I should have known who that partner was. I couldn't engage in that conversation. I was asked a question. I didn't know. So, you know, do your homework is definitely important. But the last thing to your question I'd say is the sphere of influence. I think people underestimate this, and it's something I call a sphere of influence, and I coach a lot of people internally and externally on this notion. And that is, you know, back in the day, they might call this politics. I think that has a really negative connotation. I think ultimately, if you want to be a leader, you have to broaden your sphere as relates to those who you can influence and can help you influence. And so literally putting that to, you know, for anyone listening in who's, you know, one of the most important things that I've done is every 6 months or so, I will literally document on a piece of paper, concentric circles. You know, the inner circle is me, and listing out people in the organization that I need to get closer to. I need to develop a stronger relationship with. I need to understand their business better in order to succeed, in order to accomplish what I need to accomplish. And when you put it to paper, it is revealing and telling. I think whenever you write something down, it does better than, you know, it does more for you than just having it in your head. But what's interesting to see is that this is not a how do I get to the CEO thing or how do I manage up thing. It's a who do I really need? And most often it ends up being a peer across the organization with whom I need to focus on in the next 3 to 6 months to accomplish what we need to accomplish together. And mine, you know, it's funny, if you look at mine now, you know, our CEO is Bob Carrigan. I have great access to Bob. He's a great guy. But almost at this, I score them, by the way. If you're in the circle, you're a 90. As you go out the concentric circles, you're a 70, you're a 60, you're a 50. The same, you know, CEO Carrigan, you know, might have the same score as the interns that were here this summer, those 30 or 40 people that I want to invest in, and I want them to come back and work for us next year. So this is not a seniority thing so much as a kind of prioritization and impact of where I need to spend my time. So the sphere of influence thing, I think, is very important. People underestimate it and certainly probably don't give it enough kind of formal attention.
Yeah, well, it's a great example. I'm going to start using that. Can I steal that?
Yeah, man.
Well, let's end on some fun stuff here. It's one of my favorite questions to ask, and that is, what's harder, leading at home or leading at the office? You mentioned 4 kids. You mentioned 25-year marriage. You mentioned 2 dogs. What's harder, leading 800 people or leading at home?
Yeah, you know, it is undoubtedly at home. I literally just had this conversation with my head of sales operations, Russ Pastina, just before this call. We were talking this morning, and you know, we're talking about our weekends and what it's like there at home. And I just don't get the same deferential treatment at home that I do here. So, you know, because the familiarity is there and for the whole reason. So leading at home is fun, but I don't know that I am the leader at home. What I say is I generally have veto authority and I'm a heavy influencer, but I try not to make the rules at home.
I understand. Well, you know, it's one of these things that I, you know, with 2 young kids, I think about a lot the responsibility that I have as a man to ensure that, you know, my kids make good decisions when the decisions really matter, right? You have 3 in college, you know, when you take your youngest to college or the last one to college, are you confident that you've done a good enough job as a father, a husband, that they're going to be equipped to make the best decisions that they can? And I think it's there's just a different dynamic. You have that at work too. You want people to make good decisions and take action, and it's just an interesting decision. I would say 9 out of 10 people say it's harder leading at home. So I think we're almost to a consensus here.
Yeah, you know, it's because we don't get that kind of, we don't have the status and the deferential treatment. But you know, my goal as a father in particular is to, you know, to raise, you know, it's a very competitive world out there. You know, in Northeast where I'm from, it's it's intense, and all I want to produce is productive members of society with a strong moral compass. And if we can do that, I think we've done our job. So, the one thing I would point out, John, it's really important. Different today from way back when, you know, when I was leading, the bleed over of personal self to professional self is so much more prevalent right now, right? The ubiquitous nature of data information, our iPhones, you probably juggle both professional and personal interactively during the day, intertwined during the day. And so there's more of an opportunity for us as at our personal lives to be present in our professional lives. And it's a very interesting dynamic vis-a-vis when we were, when I was, 10, 15 years ago, it was a very separate thing. Now it's being embraced that you bring your personal self to your professional life, and younger folks understand that because, my son's doing his homework literally on his phone, something I've never dreamed of, but their life is very virtual and on the move, and, the schoolwork and professional and personal life intertwined. I think that's a real dimension, a new dimension to professional leadership, that is intertwining your personal self and having your personal self show up in your professional life. And I think people respect that, and that's part of what we're doing here at D&B. It's a very kind of personal leadership style. And so the home and the office life couldn't be more different in terms of the empowerment I have, but it's very relevant to make sure that we're balancing both of those and embracing both of those.
Well, you're spot on. And it flips the other way, too. I mean, right, the young professional has to be very keen about what they share and how they share it and how much access they give. And, that stuff's there forever. Even the stuff that disappears can be screenshot. I mean, it flips both ways, right? I think it's really important that the leader shows their personal cards and shows some of what their personal life. But on the flip side, I think young professionals have to be very aware of their personal decisions and how it can impact them professionally. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up. Let's end on the last question. If you could have dinner with three leaders, living or dead, who would those three people be?
Yeah, it's hard to... It's hard to answer this without being a bit cliche because, you probably won't hear any answer from me that you haven't heard before, so I'll try to be a little different. I mean, the ones that come to mind are Churchill and Lincoln. I just have so much respect for Lincoln in particular. I do a lot of reading around that period of time. I just read a book called The Immortal Irishman. I just finished it. And by the way, I'm trying to always read two books, one on the personal front, one on the business front, right, at the same time to balance it out. But there's a guy called Thomas Marr who was an Irishman who came over and led in the United States here and has just an amazing story. And what an interesting conversation that would be. Spoke five languages in 1860 from Waterford, England, Waterford, Ireland, and became an army general and was a governor of Wisconsin and, et cetera, goes on and on. And the Fighting Irish comes from his battalion, the 69th Battalion in New York. And
what's the book called again?
The Immortal Irishman is really good. I just finished it. So Thomas Marr would be someone. But you know what? I'm also a big I'm a music guy, a musician. I was in bands growing up. I play a little guitar, sing. And, I have lots of kind of favorite artists. And I was, I will confess I was a big Deadhead. And I'm just reading a book on Jerry Garcia. And I'd love to have lunch with Jerry Garcia. So.
It's a very eclectic group, Bob. You got
Deadhead,
Thomas Moore, and Abe Lincoln.
Exactly. I was trying to give you something that you wouldn't get otherwise. But if you look at my my music collection, you'd see how eclectic I am. So I think that's it. I think I'd probably want a broad spectrum of leaders. Maybe throw Tom Coughlin in there because I'm a big Giants fan.
I hear you. Well, hey, I really appreciate such great ideas and insight and experience. It's just you're a great model. I'm so happy you came on the show, and so we look forward to having you again soon. And we'll make sure to put all this stuff in the show notes. Certainly, send people to the right places in terms of Dun & Bradstreet and where people can find you. So, thank you so much for being here.
Fantastic. Thank you, John. I appreciate the time.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It's a real pleasure and honor to bring you stories and best practices to help you perform better at work and at home. If you enjoyed the episode, it would mean a lot to us if you'd go over and write a review and recommendation on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. It's a real pleasure to get to do this every week, so it means a lot. I get to read all of them. So until next time, remember, the world needs more leaders, not less.